Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 162 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today has been one of the biggest movie stars in Hollywood for the past decade. A dashing young man who became world famous for playing the vampire Edward Cullen in all five installments of the Twilight franchise, and now is generating widespread acclaim for his acting chops as well, thanks to his career-best performance in the crime thriller Good Time, which opens on August 11th. Robert Pattinson. The 31-year-old Brit started appearing in films in his teens, with an early break being a supporting part in two installments of the Harry Potter franchise. Shortly thereafter, when he wound up being cast by Catherine Hardwicke opposite Kristen Stewart in the first Twilight, which came out in 2008, his life changed in a major way. Pattinson was catapulted onto Hollywood's A-list, which came with fame and fortune, but also a loss of privacy and certain preconceptions about what he wanted or was capable of doing as an actor. In between the Twilight films, the last of which was released in late 2012, Pattinson also acted in others, including 2010's Remember Me, 2011's Water for Elephants, and 2012's Belle Ami. But it was the first thing that he did after the Twilight chapter of his life came to an end that made people really sit up and begin regarding him as more than just another pretty face. Namely, playing the lead in David Cronenberg's Cosmopolis, also released in 2012, followed in 2014 by key parts in two films that premiered at the Cannes Film Festival, Cronenberg's Map to the Stars and David Michaud's The Rover. Since then, he's appeared in Werner Herzog's Queen of the Desert in 2015, James Gray's The Lost City of Z in 2016, and most recently, Josh and Benny Safdie's Good Time, which also premiered at Cannes, where it was greeted by a 6-minute standing ovation, and where Pattinson reportedly came very close to being awarded the jury's Best Actor prize. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, Pattinson and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them, how a young person who was discouraged by his school's drama teacher from even pursuing acting wound up a professional actor in the first place, what his life was like during the years he spent in the business prior to Twilight, and how he ultimately wound up in that film, which he understood to be an indie, what it was like to suddenly become not only world famous, but also preyed upon, in a sense, by a certain segment of the Twihard fan base, and how his relationship at the time with co-star Kristen Stewart may have contributed to that, how being associated with the Twilight franchise impacted other opportunities, and how he has shed the notion that some had of him as merely a brooding hunk through the Cronenberg collaborations and, perhaps most of all, through Good Time, plus much more. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Thank you for joining us, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We always just begin every episode with basic question: where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in a place called Barnes in London, in southwest London, just outside of central London. Well, then now I guess it's probably classified as central London.
Right. And your folks?
My dad did a number of things, but was a car dealer. My mom worked with him, and then she was a booker at a model agency before that.
So from what I was reading, just going back to even the Harry Potter days, just interviews and things that I could find, it seems like actually music was the passion before acting. Is that right?
Yeah. And then I was doing a lot of gigs and stuff right up until Twilight, really.
Really?
Like maybe up until a few months before it came out. And yeah, and all of my friends were doing it.
You have an instrument or you're a vocalist or what was it?
I spent piano, guitar, and singing.
Yeah.
I mean, like, but everybody was doing it in London at the time. It was when there was a sort of new folk revival.
Yeah. And you're actually, people can hear some of it on the Twilight soundtrack, right? I think the first one, at least, right?
Yeah, it's still quite, I can't really believe that. Yeah, it was kind of an, because I was still doing open mics whilst I was shooting Twilight, and that's how the director found out about that.
found out that you were able to sing.
Yeah, yeah. Because there was a bar right next to the hotel we were staying in. I played like twice a week, the whole way through shooting.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, before we even get to that, let's also cover some other stuff that went on before. How about modeling? You were 12. How did that enter the picture? Is your family business, or what was the way in?
Yeah, kind of. Like, my mom knew some people. Well, actually, no, she didn't know anyone who was part of it. She just kind of said, I was pretty tall when I was a kid, and I was doing a paper route at the time. My mom was like, you should go and try and do this. And then I used to also work for like a catering company and worked at whose house? It was someone's house. I was like kind of cleaning up or something, and someone said, oh, you should do this thing. And then I went in with my mom to an agency, and then there were just like tons of pretty girls everywhere, and everyone took you seriously. And it was like, oh, I should do this instead of doing a paper.
Yeah, I would think so.
But then never got any jobs, like, ever. Well, I got like 4 jobs, and then 10,000 castings and 4 jobs.
So what was it that led to you getting involved with, I guess it started out with sort of amateur theater in Southwest London, particularly though, I'm curious, because it sounds like from one of these things that I read, you were actually discouraged from pursuing creative stuff by your own school's drama teacher. So that's a weird thing for that person to have done. So how did this all go down that you wind up in an amateur theater program?
I mean, I wanted to do drama, and yeah, my teacher told me not to do it, and so like, I didn't end up doing it. Ended up doing,
like, what kind of a teacher says that?
I know. She told me not to do art either, which also I wanted to do, and I went to a pretty arty school, which is kind of weird. She's like, yeah, you shouldn't be doing this. But then that sounds terrible. My dad was at a restaurant, and there were a bunch of pretty girls who were at a thing, and he asked them where they'd been, and they said, we go to this amateur drama company.
This is the Barnes Theater Company?
Barnes Theater Company. And he said, yeah, should go and join this.
He was looking out for you. He had your back.
Yeah.
So you go off there, you start auditioning and getting into shows. And then how did you, I guess while you were there, what happened that led to you getting an agent for the first time?
I think that's basically the first part I played. Right. And just by total coincidence, the person who ran the company, his daughter was best friends with my still agent in London. And so he said to her to come down. I was probably 15, maybe.
What were you performing?
Our Town, Thornton Wilder. And I'd only got the part because it was an under 18s theatre company. Right. And all of the tall people went to university. And I was literally the only one tall enough to make it look normal.
Which part were you playing?
George,
it could be. George, it sounds fun. Yeah, no, I'm just trying George. To picture this. So you did you know when you went out, whatever you were doing that day, that there was somebody out there watching, or did you find out later?
I had no idea. Yeah, I was still at that time really hadn't. I was not thinking about doing it. I enjoyed it, and I really liked being in the world of sort of theater and stuff. But I was mainly just working backstage doing like sound effects and stuff, and I was a stagehand.
So what were you thinking, sort of, and not that you have to know your whole future in high school, but I mean, what was sort of on the radar as possible things you might do?
Nothing. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't really thinking anything. I mean, nothing.
Well, I'll ask you one thing, which I think you recently revealed, which was that you're not necessarily the most well-behaved kid in that time of your life, right?
That was younger.
Oh, that was a better. That was younger?
Yeah, no, I was like 11.
So you got to tell me, because I mean, this was hilarious. That I'm sure not at the time, but
it's so funny. It's like a story to have kind of. I can't believe
people need new stuff.
I run out of stories right. After a while.
No, this is great. But I mean, so what? You saw some magazines you liked?
I mean, I guess I was a slight kleptomaniac for a period of like 9 to 11. Yeah, just one of those things, because I was quite a well-behaved kid, and I need to kind of try and find opportunities to be bad. Yeah. And like, and that was stealing porno magazines. So, but it wasn't like we were all like little children, and like no one knew. It wasn't just like, oh.
So there weren't like major consequences when you got busted, or what?
No, it's major consequences. Yeah, it was bad. Like, it was like I went to a very very strict school at the time, and it was kind of up until 13 or whatever. It was pretty sort of academic school, and everyone would go to the same, they would have the same path, you go to like the certain university or whatever, and then because of that I ended up going to a kind of much more liberal school afterwards and a completely different.
So it changed. It did have a.
Yeah, no, it's great.
Okay, so you get the agent, as we were saying earlier, through our town. What resulted from that? Is there just a bunch of auditions what changed?
I mean, my first audition was for Troy.
Really?
I get to play Garrett Hedlund's part.
Okay.
I was friends with now.
Yeah.
And I just remember getting the call because I still didn't know what. I had literally no idea what acting was or anything. And then it suddenly became very real that, like, oh, go to this room and it's to play Brad Pitt's cousin.
Right.
And I was just like, what? Like, what are you talking about?
Where do you even begin? Yeah.
Yeah. And then went in but I'd done a bunch of modeling castings before. And modeling castings is incredibly demoralizing in a lot of ways. I mean, you line up for 2 hours and then people don't even look. They look at your book just be like, no. And I'd done hundreds of those before.
Right.
And so then doing the first ever acting audition, you're in there for an hour and you actually feel that you're kind of
engaged.
You know, there's a process and it's interesting. Right. And, you know, especially when you first start and you're young, like, casting directors really want to see if you've got anything. So they really work with you. And I just thought it was amazing afterwards and just it's completely a really life-changing audition.
So what was the first one that actually panned out?
Vanity Fair with Mira and I.
And we just had Reese on this past week.
Oh, really?
Sounds like you get the part, that's a big deal, but then what, they clipped it from the movie?
Yeah. It was the end scene as well. It was playing Reese's son, estranged son,
mm-hmm.
and it was supposed to be the end. It was this big kind of final sad moment.
Right.
I did that, and also one of my best friends, Tom Sturridge, was the other son. Right. I mean, it was both of our first parts.
Right.
We went to school together. We were in adjacent scenes. And then we went to the screening and no one had told me that I was cut out.
Geez.
And so we saw his scene and we're like, yeah, pretty good. And then it gets to my one and it's just you're not there.
you would meet Reese again in another movie that we will come to. Not as son and mother. That's Hollywood. So, all right. At 17, though, it sounds like that was the first big one, right? You go out and you get Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And then I guess come back in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix 2 years later, the part of Cedric Diggory.
Mm-hmm.
Did that feel like a huge break at the time?
Yeah. I mean, well, I'd done this other movie called The Ring of the Nibelungs, which also came out a million different titles all over the world. But I went straight from Vanity Fair into The Ring. Just like that, to be honest, was the most mind-blowing experience because it was kind of being, I think I just turned 17 and going to spend 3 months in Cape Town like to shoot this thing. I was still just like, what is going on? Like, how is this happening?
Yeah.
And it was just amazing. Like, the entire experience was amazing. I'd somehow managed to convince my mom that I didn't need a guardian.
Oh,
so I was literally, I think I maybe was 16 when I got it.
Really?
At the beginning. And so I was just in Cape Town by myself in my own apartment. And like, I was like, oh, this is the life for me.
Yeah. Now, was being on those sets and seeing the impact of being in a big franchise on the people who were leading that one, what impression did that leave on you?
I mean, in Harry Potter, it was very, I really realized, I mean, they're also very nice kids. Well, they're not kids anymore, but they're at the time, even though they were lovely.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very protected. I mean, the set, because most of that stuff was within the studio, was in Leavesden Studios, and they'd had the same people working there for the same crew and everything. It was quite a specific environment and a lot of kids, and they had to go to school. And I was probably one of the oldest young people there. And I could see that it was kind of, however they did it and within Harry Potter, they really, really did it right.
Yeah.
And that's why all of them ended up pretty good people afterwards.
Yeah. So what's strange to me is that you've said that in the years between that first of the Harry Potters that you were in and then the first of the Twilights, it was actually pretty lean as far as work for you. There wasn't like a Harry Potter bounce?
Well, kind of. I mean, I got my American representation from Harry Potter, and there was a kind of moment where it sort of seemed like, you know, there's like a bunch of stuff going on, and then, it just didn't, nothing really. But then I went back to England, and I did just kind of, just interesting things. And then I can't remember even the exact order of things, but I remember I did a TV show on BBC Three where I was playing a World War II pilot with PTSD and stuff. And I just kind of, it felt like a kind of, it's like, oh, you're like doing a part.
Right,
and it kind of, and then that was sort of started to change things in my head. And then I did like a comedy thing with Catherine Tate, who's an English comedian. And that was kind of fun. And then I played young Salvador Dali, which that was just another like completely crazy experience. And doing, you know, you kind of, especially if you haven't really decided if you're going to act or not. I mean, suddenly you're doing things where it's like, you're seeing where your line of comfort is. And also it was the first time as well I'd really researched a part doing that. And it's sort of, I mean, I met a bunch of people who knew Dali, and things started like falling into place. And
so by that point, you're now becoming more convinced that this is what you want to pursue.
Yeah. But like, it's still not entirely. I was still 100% doing music at the time. And everyone I knew was getting signed at the time as well, like who I'd started playing gigs with. But the music industry just seemed so precarious to me. So I was a little bit. And also I was getting jobs. I was kind of getting little jobs, but like I was every single time I would just about to be saying I'm done with this, and I'd get another one. Right. So like it was just lucky.
As I understand it, this agent that you mentioned before, I think Stephanie Ritz, says, come to LA, we've got an audition for some romantic comedy. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I mean, I was doing tapes all the time. I'd be sending hundreds and hundreds of tapes all the time.
Okay, so did this not actually involve you coming to Los Angeles?
Well, yeah, well, I sent the tape. And I used to do tapes with Tom Sturridge.
Like, okay, we tape each other. Yeah.
And he would always play the girl. We'd play the girl for each other. We'd always be auditioning for the same thing.
Right.
And get really, really into it. We'd lived in the same apartment together, and we'd do like these hundreds and hundreds of auditions. And we do it, and we didn't even have like a digital camera. It was like one, like a mini, what are they, like a Sony Handycam, which is from the early 90s. And then send the tape, and then WME had to edit them up afterwards.
Like, make them earn their money, yeah.
But I did this one tape, and I was like, this is the one, this is going to do it. And Stephanie and the producer were saying, like, yeah, you've got it. It's basically, it's on a plate. You just need to come and meet everybody.
And this was a romantic comedy.
It's a romantic comedy. And then went in to do that. And also I knew that I wasn't good at auditioning, and I just got this crazy anxiety build up and would ruin it every time. And I went in to do this audition and just completely flaked. And like, it was terrible. And I could feel it as soon as I walked in the room. It was just like, nah, this
after
isn't going
to
happen.
All the way to LA.
And it was like, it was like spend £700 on the flight and everything. And I was like sleeping on Stephanie's couch. And yeah. And I walked in, and as soon as I did it, I was like, that's never going to happen.
What do? You go back to her place and...
Yeah, well, I remember I called my parents afterwards. I was like, oh, I'm done with this. And like my parents were just being like, so yeah, well, you know, just don't do it then if it's making you so upset.
Yeah.
And I was like, don't tell me what to do.
You're going to decide.
Yeah, you have to do the opposite.
Right.
And then, the Twilight audition was the next day, maybe.
But this was not something that you even knew about when you came to LA. It was just like, oh, by the way, you're here. Might as well.
It actually was. And this is like kind of how little I talked to Catherine. And I don't understand how it had really... I talked to her when I was in London, but I'd come out for something else. And I hadn't even really remembered the conversation. And I was supposed to have read the book and all this stuff, but I'd specifically come out for something else.
And you hadn't read the book?
No, I hadn't done it. And because I was so certain. I was like, the other one was on a flip.
That's the one, yeah.
And then, so yeah, I went to do that audition.
So your agent says, as long as you're here and Catherine, you might go do your audition.
And she was like, you know, Catherine just got this house in Venice. And it's like, you're just going to be like chilling out. She's probably going to make you smoke weed or whatever.
And meanwhile, at least they were reporting that she's seen thousands and thousands of people. I mean, is that true? 5,000 people?
I mean, I was the last person they saw, like on the last day. And I genuinely have no idea how, because I talked to her, and I remember talking to her on the phone, and she called me up, and it was like 3 a.m. in London. And I was just like, and I still hadn't read the book even then. And then she was like, oh, so how do you see the character? I was like, oh man, he's just like sex machine. And I didn't even understand what the conversation was.
Right. Well, I mean, just to further contextualize here, you've said in one of these other profiles that the year prior to that audition, I guess, you're living, as you say, with Tom Sturridge in, quote, a cool little ex-crack den, close quote, and that you said I spent the prior year drunk and basically just not in the best of places, right? So you come here. What happened at that first of, I guess, two auditions? What went on at her house?
I mean, it was just weird. Just one of those things where you kind of once you have super high expectations of the previous one, and then that's just taken away from you. Then I had zero expectations of the other one. So I went in completely, I'd also taken, if you listen to How It's Done, yes. I was taking a Valium for the first time in my life. So it's probably why I didn't have
any
notes.
Now, that was because you were nervous or you just felt like,
yeah,
why not?
Well, I mean, because I felt super comfortable about it. And then as soon as, like, I was literally just about to get into a taxi, and then the same crippling anxiety happened, and I was like calling up Stephanie, just having a panic attack in her apartment, going, I can't go. And she's like, oh, just take this thing.
Yeah.
And I just remember like driving in the cab.
Well, that'll have you more than brooding for that part.
Yeah. And it was just kind of, but it also just made you kind of think you don't have to just perform. Like, you can go there and just listen.
Yeah.
And I'd never thought about it. I just thought it was like, I thought every single time you did something, it was like, prove everything all at once.
Right.
And just going in there, and I was like, oh, hey. And I also couldn't, I was so messed that I couldn't even find a house. I was like half an hour late.
Pre-Uber in those days. Yeah. But what did she want out of you when you were there? Did she want you to read the script or act the scene, or what were you actually doing to earn the part?
Yeah. I mean, it was just like, we did like four different scenes. And also, I was very serious about that stuff. Like, I mean, I didn't see it as a popcorn movie or whatever. I mean, even if it's written as that, like, I still want to approach it the same way. So I was asking tons of questions and blah, blah, blah.
Well, plus the original was basically approached not unlike an indie movie, right?
Yeah, that's what I thought it was. I mean, I'd seen 13 before, and I really liked 13. Yeah. And I thought that was what it was. Like, right. I mean, and I hadn't read the book, and I'd only seen the sides. And so I was like, well, I assume that's, you know, you make it like 13.
Right.
I don't know.
Like, so that first time you, her, Kristen Stewart, then there's a second audition, a final audition?
No, we just did that. And then I just met the producers after. There was just one audition. And then
they were not as sold on you as she was, right?
No one was. I mean, it's kind of, well, they all thought I looked really old. Like, and I was pretty chubby at the time too.
Had you just not shaved, or what was it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was kind of associated with the probably 2 or 3 years of just basically just
drinking,
just drinking, right. playing music all the time. Yeah, it wasn't. I remember at the end of the audition, we went in Catherine's garden, and she was like, you know, all the other guys, he's supposed to be so chiseled, he's an Adonis, so you just want to see what your body looks like. Right. And I was literally just like,
oh, geez.
I'm not going to do it. Sorry. I just realized I was the only guy who didn't do it.
Oh, my gosh.
And I was kind of so
she went to bat for you. That's how you got past the skeptical producers?
Yeah, and well, I did. Yeah, I mean, I actually got on pretty well with the producers afterwards, but like, I went to do another meeting a week later and just tried to shave about 10 times.
Look a little younger.
Yeah, shave my chest as well.
Where were you when you found out you got it? And did you realize that this, in that moment, was potentially going to majorly change your life?
I was still at Stephanie's, and then I kind of knew I was going to get. I also sent Catherine a letter and kind of, I could feel, you sort of feel it. I didn't know what the kind of consequence were, but I knew it was a sequel. I knew there was three of them. I knew there was something that was going to happen. And also, I just like got a job. I always felt, you know, it's always amazing. I mean, I only ever got like, still to this day, I only ever get a maximum of like 2 jobs a year. That's literally, two good days.
But there's not anyone at that point who's saying, for any reason, because of celebrity that might come with their things, that nobody was advising against taking it?
No. You couldn't even get the books, and I had to order the books off Amazon, which was just a bookseller at the time.
Right.
Like, I mean, it's like you couldn't. I remember looking around everywhere, and like no one had heard of it. Like, no one believes me, but like no one had heard of it. There was one person, a waitress I knew who knew it, but it was culty.
Like, so it blew up only as a result of the movie, or how, like, because the books obviously themselves became huge, but you're saying that was, when did that start?
About 6 months before the movie came out. And you could really feel like suddenly it was growing and growing. And then by the time the movie came out, it was everywhere.
From what I've read, they had you address they got you a trainer, right? So you could be comfortable with your shirt off or whatever. That was one thing that you did to prep. What else could you do to prep? How do you, now that you, I assume eventually you read the book.
Yeah.
What else though? I mean, you're approaching it. It's a big, probably clearly already, even before the movie opened, it was maybe your biggest job.
Yeah.
What could you do to get ready?
It was my first American job as well. And it just felt like a big thing. I mean, I went super early which is the only thing I really realized how to do, and just be by myself in Portland for like, I think I went about 2 months before even I was supposed to come for pre-production, and I was just there forever. There was no one even there. It was just the stunt team.
Right.
Like, and so I'd hang out with them and just kind of obsess over things. And and just kind of just think, okay, my only idea was if you're just here longer and invest more time than everyone else when they come, then you'll hopefully feel at least an equal.
Was the most intimidating aspect of it?
Just doing it, just like being self-defeating. Like, I mean, just kind of getting over, as always, I just experienced it too many times. And then I thought, like, okay, this is like the big show.
Right.
Like you can't mess it up.
And in terms of just one other thing pre-release of the movie was that you've said, and I think this was another one of these recent things that people didn't realize, that you almost didn't make it to the final cut. I mean, it was not resonating with, I guess, the producers again, or what was the issue?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's because I had a really satisfying experience on the thing playing Dali, and I was very argumentative with like on the thing before. And I would like say, I thought that if you are supposed to be playing a character, you should make yourself believe that you should be the only one who you should know the most about the character, and like, and you should be an authority on it. And if someone, and you should defend it as well. And I thought that was a good thing.
Well, so what was the difference of opinion?
I mean, the main thing was I kept wanting to push to say the logic of the story and the characters means that, like, you know, if you touch someone and then you want to kill them after, it's like, you should probably avoid touching them. And also I was really obsessed with, you know, that kind of, the longing becomes a painful thing. And I thought that was what the story was supposed to be about. So I thought we should never touch each other. We should try and, you know, and it's a painful thing to be around each other. And I thought I'd never really seen that in a teen romance thing. And like, that is essentially what the story is. Like,
so their issue is they want a guy who's a little bit more upbeat.
Yeah, well, just like accessible. Because a lot of people just want to see people be happy together.
Right.
Especially if it's a relationship happening. But I mean, I think it kind of ended up being a sort of a nice compromise between the two.
So the weekend this opens, you're 22 years old. What do you remember of that weekend, and how quickly, I guess, and in what ways did things change when people saw this movie?
I remember doing Comic-Con, which was crazy, but nothing, my life didn't change at all. I was still living in the Oakwood Apartments in Burbank, and like, it was just funny. I went there, have everybody screaming, and then you just go back, and it was just exactly the same. There was no paparazzi or anything. And then we did this whole press tour, and like, and I just kept, I hadn't understood that, you know, we did this Hot Topic press tour in like malls around America, and there was this like total madness, and it's on like local news and blah, blah, blah. But then I just go back and it was gone. And so it's like, oh, well, so it's just when you do these events, that's it. It's not actually your life.
Right.
And then when the premiere happened, it was genuinely the only time, the first time I'd really realized that I'd made a film. Like, and it's sort of, and I was sitting there and just, up until that point, it was just all a laugh, like, and it's like you're just kind of saying stupid things and in press events and stuff, and just, I just want to make it fun for myself, and then you suddenly notice it, and it was the first time you actually saw yourself, and it's like, oh, I actually did something, like, and it was very frightening, and I left immediately. I left the next day back to England.
But what was frightening was not seeing yourself; it was what the reaction of other people seeing you.
Yeah, it was the reaction in the audience, and it's kind of like, because I'd seen a few other movies that I'd done, and it's like you just watch them like every other movie. Like, you just watch it, and you're just watching a movie. Right. Like, but at this, like, characters would come on screen, and people would scream at the theater and stuff. And, like, there's just this, like, mayhem, like, real hysteria. And you suddenly realize that I'm not in control of this at all. And you suddenly realize, like, you're like, fuck, I'm going to become a commodity. And then, and I was too young to really realize how to cope with it. There's no way to know how to cope with it. And
well, I'll just read back to you, because I thought it was an interesting quote, because remember, so for listeners, this was the first one comes out in 2008. You're probably one or two more in by 2011, which is just 6 years after you had been the supporting guy in the Harry Potter movies. And here's in 2011 is something that Emma Watson, the star of that, said about your sort of fame that had already happened by 2011. She said, quote, "I can't even imagine what that kind of fame must be like. So many people must wish they were in his position and think he has the best life, but actually there are prices to pay. Don't interpret that from my perspective. It's not so bad for me. I'm not in Rob's position. I don't have people screaming and crying and clawing at me. I'm so grateful for that," close quote. But, I mean, what?
She 100% does.
she has some, but I mean, I guess because her maybe viewer, the average Harry Potter viewer, maybe slightly younger.
Yeah.
I mean, because we should ask this, because you're even long after Twilight, this is still a relevant topic. Who, as you saw, is the archetypal Twilight fan, the people or the obsessive, the people that gave you this nickname that I know you're not in love with, the R-Pats, the people who feel an emotional stake in your personal business, all of this stuff. I mean, who are these people?
They are the real kind of vocal ones. I think it's a very, very, very small group. Quite educated women between the ages of 28 and 60. Well, I mean, that's quite a lot of women. But the older, like, I mean, like, they're not old, obviously, but like kind of, they're not teenagers at all. And that's what people never really realize. They were like kind of, the initial wave of them was young, but the actual they're significantly older.
So what's their deal? I mean, that you would think you outgrow that kind of thing.
It's like a kind of, it's so specific, Twilight. I mean, it's like, and so if you feel like that's been totally catered towards you, and you have, and then also you see something, which I think that's why a lot of people feel a sense of ownership over it, because it did come from a very small thing and it was very personal and private. I mean, it becomes this massive thing and you kind of, people feel like they were on the journey. But I think like the majority of people who went to see Twilight were just like just random people. Right, I mean, like it's kind of, it wasn't just all like kind of Twihards.
One question I have is, when throughout those years, and I'm going to try to approach this in a way that's proper here. I mean, like, do you think that it, in hindsight, made your life infinitely harder and sort of fueled those people's fantasies or, you know, expectations or their issues or whatever when you were involved with a co-star? Does that just add fuel to the fire?
I don't know specifically. I mean, because you kind of, there's plenty of series of relationships and stuff where like people just imagine anyway.
Right.
Like even when we weren't together, the people were saying we were anyway. Right. It doesn't make any difference. But like it's kind of, it's sort of, still now. Still
now. They're never going to give in. They'll never accept it.
It definitely does change your paparazzi involvement in your life, like 100%. It's just an economic thing. It's just two people in a photo, like rather than.
Right.
And I think anything, it's like the most relatable thing for anyone who reads a gossip magazine is like, what's the state of a relationship?
Right.
Like those things. Any, if everyone's having the same thing.
Right.
And so you do, that's why there's these constant stories of anyone who's had any kind of coupling with anybody.
Like, well, you've said a bunch of times that you're sort of like a homebody type person. You don't like to go out a lot. But was that the case even before all of this, or is that the result of this?
No, I mean, I'm not really a homebody. I mean, I kind of. I'm like a bougie Hollywood guy.
But I mean, in the sense, like, did this whole side stuff that comes with all this, does it change your willingness or ability to go out and just do the things that you would have done?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had a moment where because I was so busy up until 25 or something, that I never had a time to really process anything.
Yeah,
and you're just in the eye of the storm. And then I really had a moment at 25 where I was kind of, I'd been trying to live the previous life that I was living, and just because you're so busy, you could sort of ignore what it was happening. And then I had a real moment when it kind of started to, when the series was sort of ending and I'd slow down a little bit. It's like, oh, the life you had previously has died. Mm-hmm. And like, and you're kind of, and you're just in this other world.
Was there one thing that hammered that home?
No, I just remember kind of just feeling like I was sort of freaking out a little bit. Like, and really I got Cosmopolis, and that really it suddenly made you realize that, oh, there's like a whole point. Like, there was a point in why you started doing this in the first place. And it's like, and now you have.
Getting closer to that.
Yeah. And you have a chance to do it. And like,
well, we should note that during the, I don't know, however many months they would have between each Twilight movie, what was it, like four or something months, roughly? So you would be within your rights to take those hiatuses and just like lie on your couch. But it seems like throughout the entire process, you kept working on other films that were very different. Mm-hmm. And let's just remind people, there was Remember Me, which came out in 2010 about 9/11. There was Water for Elephants, which came out in 2011. You're this depression era guy who joins a circus after his parents are killed. Bellamy in 2012, climbing the Paris social ladder by sort of playing wealthy women. These are very different sorts of things. Why work when you didn't have to work? And would you say that you were trying to prove something to yourself, to others? Was there some motivation for that?
No, I mean, I just knew after the first premiere, like, you feel there was such a weight put on it, but like, there was just no choice. Like, you had to diversify very quickly.
Yeah.
Like, or at least otherwise. And I knew as well, there was going to be like a ton, there's five of them.
Yeah.
And so like, if you just waited to do five movies, I mean, that's like your whole 20s. And like, it's kind of, And also because, you know, once you're in a role of working, that's kind of, you know, you just want to sit around. Now I just want to sit around all the time.
Yeah. Well, so what were the biggest preconceptions that some other filmmakers might have had of you because of Twilight? And did you, you know, as you were seeking other kinds of things, was that impression of, all right, this is this guy, this is what he does, was that an impediment in any way?
No, I mean, well, no more so than just being like tall and blonde. Right. Like, I mean, it's sort of like, you kind of, it's the same thing. And I'd always wanted to play like kind of, you want to play character parts. And everyone's like, well, you're not really a character looking kind of person. And like, and so you get kind of frustrated at that. But I mean, I don't think, I mean, it was weird when Twilight people thought that that was me playing myself, which is like, I just always thought
that
it was.
You're saying the Twilight filmmakers thought that your character in that was basically you?
What? Not the filmmakers, like the kind of, but other filmmakers.
I got
like, which I never ever understood it because I was always like, what? Have you never seen anything? But I guess most people don't see an interview or anything. Right. And so they're just like, they just assume like that's, oh, right. They watch a movie
and
that's
heavily marketed and whatever.
Yeah.
You did work, we should know, like some of these directors that did some of these Twilight movies are top directors,
yeah.
Bill Condon and other people there.
Yeah, Chris White.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you're doing these ones during the hiatuses, then Twilight is winding down, and I guess it was around then that you landed Cosmopolis, this first of two collaborations so far with David Cronenberg. How did that come about? Did he ever tell you what it was about you that made him think of you?
No, I mean, I'd read the script a long time previously, and I loved the script, but I thought I was way too young for it, and I hadn't even met him, and it was just an offer, and I literally couldn't believe it. And I remember just, I was nervous to even call back to say I'd do it, because I was like, I don't know, and I remember calling back and saying, like, I was like, I really like it, I really want to do it, I just don't really get it. And he's like, that's fine. Don't worry. And like, it was just, I mean, he's like, that's his character. Just being like, you know, you don't really need to understand it. It's fine.
Well, you've said it was, you've called it a life-changing experience. And just to remind people, you're playing this, I guess, young billionaire who has a bad day where it all starts to fall apart. And just 2 years later, back with him. So he obviously was pleased with how it went, and you were as well. And do you think, though, that having done Cosmopolis and then also later Map to the Stars with him, which goes to Cannes at the same time as The Rover, to have two in the festival in 1 year is a pretty special thing. What changed in those 2 or 3 years about the perception of who you were, what you were capable of, what you wanted to do?
I mean, it's a slow turn. I mean, it's just kind of, you know, everyone was asking even then, saying, oh, are you worried about being typecast and blah, blah, blah. So I was always like, I'm getting the jobs I want to do.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't want to rock the boat, whatever is the reason I'm getting these jobs.
Yeah.
And like, you know, too much to a lot of people's detriment who I work with, like, I don't even care if they make money at all.
Yeah,
like, I'm
literally,
as long as I can get another one.
Right. Like, it seems like the big thing for you is the director, because we should also note, so David Michaud did The Rover, Werner Herzog did Queen of the Desert a year after that, James Gray, Lost City of Z a year after that, and now the Safdie brothers who are coming to with Good Time. But is that the main consideration for you, just people that you want to work with?
Definitely at one point. I mean, I was kind of, I mean, obviously there were people who I loved, but at the same time, I was aware of a credibility deficit. And so you think if Herzog and Anton Corbijn and all these different people say, well, they're hiring me. So I was like, I was hoping that all these people say, well, you're going to have to shit on your heroes if you want to shit on me.
That's great.
That was kind of the.
It really, for any and all flack that you ever took for Twilight, it's only 5 years ago was the last one, and here we are 5 years later, and you know, you're in the best actor discussion at Cannes. So it is a pretty nice, amazing, you know, I'm sure it doesn't feel like just like a quick turnaround for you, but
it really does.
Yeah.
Well, but I knew as well, I knew as soon as I signed on to do a multiple sequels to something, I was like, it's going to take 10 years to go this. It's like,
you figured that out early.
I said it to my agent. Yeah. And it took 10 years.
Let's say today you could go back to the moment when you were offered, you know, yes or no, do you want to do Twilight? Knowing everything that came with that, the good, the bad, and the ugly, would you say yes again?
Yeah, 100%. It's all good.
Yeah.
Like,
well, not all good if you can't go to the, you know, if you've got crazy people or whatever.
But at the end of the day, it's literally, who really wants to do anything?
Right.
You just like, you just got Postmates.
So, but you ultimately weigh it and you say it was the right move.
Oh, yeah, 100%. I always known it was the right move. But it's kind of, it's unbelievable. I mean, this is also I made these decisions when it wasn't like, oh, should I choose this one or that thing. It was like, these are the only jobs I was getting. And I wouldn't have done any of this other stuff if not for that.
So let's come to this great movie that premiered at Cannes this year, just back in May, and then has been on the festival circuit since then, picking up all kinds of acclaim and accolades. This is Good Time, a movie by the Softy brothers, Benny and Josh. You're playing Connie, a small-time crook in New York.
Josh was saying, describing it as a romantic psychopath.
Romantic psychopath. Relatively like present day, right? It seems. So how did this one come about, and were you aware of the Softy brothers' prior work, which really wasn't, as they've said, this is our first movie, but how did this all come together with you?
I just randomly came across this still from Heaven Knows What, mm-hmm. and really liked it. And it's so, I just never like anything. And so it's kind of, if you get that feeling, it's the same feeling which I got with seeing White Material, the Claire Denis movie. And right. I was just like, I know, I 100% know I had to do it. And it's only happened to me a few times in my life. And so like, I just really, really went after it. Mm-hmm. Like I've been trying up until that point, I would do movies where the world was so self-contained, like in Cosmopolis and all these different things stylistically, like mm-hmm. that you wouldn't necessarily be judging just a performance in that movie. You should be completely taken away from reality. It's something you have to just totally accept every facet of the world which the filmmaker's creating. And I loved, like, when I saw Heaven Knows What and the seamlessness between performances in the real world and just on the street and stuff. Yeah. I was like, if I could do something like that, that's going to be what I want
to
do.
And that would really require you to do what you had said you'd wanted to do years earlier, which was to basically be a character actor, right? Yeah. You'd have to change your appearance. You're going to have to do some things. Yeah.
And it's all from like the kind of stupid insecurities from being younger. And like, oh, you're a private schoolboy from London. And it's like, you can never do this and you can never do that, blah, blah, blah. And obviously it's like some kind of like white privilege kind of thing, but at the same time, it's like, you know, everybody wants to be the opposite of not necessarily the opposite, but like everybody doesn't like being told this is the only thing you can do. So I've been trying to do, I think it's interesting to try and empathize with different archetypes, and that's the whole point of acting.
Yeah. And there's nothing about this guy that reminds anyone of anything that you'd previously done. Nothing glamorous about this guy. Mm-hmm. He's sweaty, he's kind of greasy hair, and he's got a Queens accent and all these things. That one thing that Josh Softy said of you recently was, quote, "He doesn't need money. What he's after is so much more existential. He related to Connie in that regard. He felt imprisoned and that he couldn't be free because of the Twilight thing," close quote. Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Not really.
Not really. You disagree with that?
I've always felt very free. I mean, it's literally, you just need like the, and I just always found that it's kind of, I mean, I've just been extremely lucky though. So it's kind of, I've like basically found these jobs at certain points in my life, which just suddenly really appealed to me. And like, and I'll try and find something which feels really different to anything I've done before. But I knew at the beginning, I've never really felt trapped by it. I've never felt like, even when I was doing it, I would do the other movies, I've never felt trapped by anything. And I guess it's kind of like, and I try, it's a conscious decision to not be trapped by it, like, and not get kind of overwhelmed by it.
One of the things people should know is that Benny Softy, one of these two brothers who directed this, also plays your mentally challenged younger brother, Nick, in this. When you heard that he would be playing that part, which I don't think was known when you initially Mm-mm. signed on, what did you make of that, and then how did you guys develop this? I was reading about some really interesting stuff where you were having an email correspondence in character, mm-hmm. that you guys were coming up with pretty detailed backstories dealing with things that we never see or hear mm-hmm. about in the movie. But just talk about the way they and you work to make this feel like such, these characters feel so believable.
Yeah, I mean, I think they wrote a lot of the script by, Josh and Ronnie, the Brunstein, the co-writer, they wrote incredibly detailed backstories. And I was getting, I kind of got the script in piecemeal, like over a year or so, like, and then it would come with an idea and some photographs of images of people who the character could look like. And then there were just news stories as well about like the Richard Matt and David Sweat and Richard Matt.
Or
Richard
these other guys, robbers, right?
And just this kind of thing where these guys are like murderers and people would be rooting for them. It's this thing, like, I mean, to escape, and all these different ideas, like different kind of, and things like just different, but like the Executioner's Song and the Spoke of the, and the Belly of the Beast, and all this, the kind of getting it all at the same time. But it was, I mean, also these kind of detailed backstories and the letters and all this stuff. But it was all coming at once. It wasn't just like a script. I mean, you'd use all this stuff afterwards to kind of fill in the ideas. It was coming in piecemeal, which is kind of, it's a nice way of building it. But yeah, I've never done that much relationship backstory with an actor before, because most of the time an actor comes in the day before. I mean, it's just impossible.
Yeah.
And also, they're only cast the day before.
Yeah, right. Well, so here, how would it work? Because technically, both Josh and then Benny, who's playing opposite you, are directors. So at the end of a take, does Benny just break a character and start directing, or how did that work?
No, I mean, he would mainly stay sort of in character if he was doing a scene with him as Nick, and then occasionally sort of break it a little bit, but not
You're
really.
Saying he would direct you as Nick?
Well, I mean, kind of. Not really. It would be like a kind of, but when he was not in the scene, he would be obviously co-directing.
Right.
Yeah, it was kind of unusual. And it's because it's also the opposite of the character dynamic is the actor-director dynamic. So it was weird. Like, if Benny would tell me something, you'd just kind of be like, shut the fuck up. I did this thing. It's kind of confusing.
Right. But so when this movie, I don't know if you'd seen it prior to Cannes, but when it goes there, where you had, again, been with two movies before, but you go there with this, and it feels like it was a different sort of reception. I don't know that... I think these are probably the best reviews of your career, right? I mean, people are falling all over themselves about this movie, and I just wonder how you've processed all of that, including from all kinds of circles of people, some people that had previously given you a hard time, people that, I mean, does it feel sort of like a special moment?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's kind of, and I think also people are responding just to the kind of style of filmmaking as well. It's kind of, it's just so fast. And like, and also just like, I mean, you can see how Josh and Benny are as people. I mean, they can, like, it's just this stream of like ideas constantly, but it also, but it's not a one way thing. They're also very good listeners as well. So like, so when you can see a movie like this where it's just so much noise and chaos and everything, but it's also extremely detailed, and like, and you know, people are watching it like, wow, they haven't seen something like this in ages. Cause it kind of feels like there's sort of elements of throwbacky kind of stuff, but then it's like, but then it's throwback, but then like on crack, basically. Like, it's kind of, it's like, just the pace of it. I think the pace feels extremely contemporary as well. I think it's like, I think only a modern audience would really be able to take it, like, because now we're so ADD now.
Right. Well, just as a last question, you know, do you see this as sort of a turning point in any way? Is it a fulfillment of an objective? Where do you go from here? Would you do, if somebody came and said, hey, we want you for another franchise, would you entertain that idea? Or are you looking for something else sort of specifically? What's the outlook at this moment?
Yeah, for sure. I'm always looking for, I mean, you look at anything, you have no idea. I mean, it's kind of, and my only thing, I just always think that it's going to be the end at any point. I've been thinking that since I started working. Right. And so like, even yesterday we had this screening, and there was just great people coming to the screening, and everybody's liking it afterwards. And I remember saying to my agent, going like, "Oh my god, is this the tipping point?" And then I sort of realized that, oh, I'm starting a Claire Denis movie in 2 weeks. That's awesome. It's crazy.
So feeling good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, and congratulations. I loved it, so I appreciate you doing this.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.